This is The Art of the Hudson Valley, broadcasting locally on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York, and streaming globally online at WGXC.org. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. And today in the Hudson studio, we'll be talking photography with our two guests, Holly Northrup and Victor Millen. Welcome, both of you.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And happens to be that I'm a photographer, too, or three, as the case may be. So we're just going to talk photography for the next hour. And Victor, this is the first time I've met you. So can you introduce yourself to me and the listeners?
Sure. Victor Millen. I'm a transplant to the area. I live in Philmont. I am originally from New York City, spent most of my life there. Philmont became our weekend destination almost 10 years ago. And 4 years ago, my wife and I and our now daughter decided to make it home. And this is where we are. I've been involved in photography for pretty seriously for about a decade now. I had taken a class in college. And after being in the corporate world for about 15 years, started taking classes at the International Center of Photography and the School of Visual Arts, as well as John Coffer's Camp Tintype up in Dundee, New York.
And what were you doing before you started the photography career?
I was a human resources manager for a brokerage firm in New York City. So it was a real switch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. That company was bought by Bain and Company, Bain Consulting, Bain Capital, actually, and then sold off in pieces to the great profit of Bain. And then we laid everybody off, including myself.
Why the switch to photography?
You know, it's funny. I actually have negatives and a camera that belonged to my grandfather. So I have my grandfather's 1935 Contax II, and I've got negatives of his that go back to definitely the 20s because my aunt's, you know, a baby. Mm. And she passed away at like 80 years old about a decade ago. And, you know, there was just always been that interest. My father took it up from there. And then he gave me a camera, I think, when I was about 19, 20 years old. Not in 1920, but when I was about 20 years old. And, you know, it's still a great camera. It's a Minolta X700. If I have one camera to bring anywhere, that's the camera I'm going to bring. It's still a reliable, lightweight, great camera. I use it all the time. Took a couple of courses in college. Loved it. Loved the darkroom. But, you know, when I graduated, it really wasn't anything I was considering seriously. But I picked it up about a decade after that. I was showing someone how to use a camera, and I found myself, you know, manipulating the f-stops and the shutter speeds and explaining everything, and it kind of reawakened my interest. And when Daytech wound down in early 2002, I just, you know, started exploring, you know, new things. And one of them was, you know, taking classes at the International Center of Photography. And I spent a good year just like immersing myself there, taking a lot of classes, and then becoming a volunteer in the dark room there. And I really learned quite a bit. I would spend, you know, entire days there. And besides taking primarily, you know, black and white classes, took a lot of classes in 19th century processes like platinum printing, you know, the wet plate collodion process. I'm really drawn towards the more antique, physical, chemical processes.
Analog, I guess you could say.
Analog, yes.
So are you using digital at all?
Yeah, I use digital primarily to scan. You know what? I really like using my scanner to make images, by the way. I use my phone to take digital images. In some of my analog workflow, I'll take a print I made or I'll take a negative and I'll use that to make an enlarged negative, which then I'll use for either platinum printing or cyanotypes. But, you know, and also when I make a tintype's a one-of-a-kind object. You know, it's an in-camera positive, so there is no negative. Mm. But if I wanted to scan that and then, you know, print a 13 by 19 print, yeah, I'll use the scanner and then make a digital print, you know, from the tintype. So, yeah, I enjoy digital. It offers a lot of opportunities. It's just not something that I've really, you know, embraced for image capture yet.
And, Holly, you are a film user.
Yes.
How did you get involved in photography?
I've been taking pictures since I was 17. I went to art school. I went to the Art Institute of Pittsburgh. And one of the classes, I went as a graphic designer, and one of the classes that I had was a photography class. So I just really enjoyed that. I wasn't a photography major because I still had to finish my course in graphic design. But I had a camera, and I just started to go from there. Started shooting 35 millimeter. And really, I've only been shooting 120 for about 10 years, probably, about 10 years.
And what would you say your specialty is, your what you like to photograph?
The city. I'm a street photographer. That's my wonderful, fun thing to do. Almost everything I shoot is that. Although I do shoot landscapes outside, you know, Hudson-y, trees, things like that. But what I really, really like to do is just wander around and take pictures in the city.
So you're doing a photographic diary?
Yeah, I guess. I guess you could say that, yes. I do a photo. I try to do a photo of the day. I used to do it a lot more than I have been the past couple of years. But and I did shoot digital for a while. I shot digital professionally, but not personally. So that was, I'm familiar with it. I don't shoot digital at all now. But it's quick to do, to do a personal diary kind of thing. And I do have a little Tumblr thing that I take photos with my little Samsung, and that's kind of fun. But it's just snappy stuff. It's
Now, it sounds like both of you are processing your own film. And
yes.
Yes, definitely.
Yep.
And I would assume most listeners probably, if they're not in tune with the history of photography, they're thinking the digital camera, and they're wondering why or how you process film.
Well, you usually start with powdered chemistry.
Well, so you do it. You're a little more... I'm a sloppy, that's what I've been told, in the darkroom, because I kind of eyeball measurements, and I use powder and things like that, but it's like, you know, 1-to-2 ratio, sure-ish, you know, because I'm using the Holga, and, you know, that's not the time to get real precise about
it. Well, describe the Holga.
It's a plastics.
Plastics.
Plastics. It's a plastic camera. I use mostly either plastic cameras or really old junky cameras. I shoot a lot of brownie stuff, and it's you open the back and there's a hole and you can see the lens. There's no the lens, it's just a hole in the camera.
So it's a pinhole.
Yeah, I guess, but it has a shutter.
It's a
click.
It's a single element, you know, plastic lens.
And yeah, that's
it's barely a lens.
It's barely.
It's like a small plastic, like foggy window.
Yes.
And
yes.
It has one shutter speed.
No, it has.
It has bulb.
It has bulb, and it that's really, and it has two f-stops that I put it on infinity and go. That's pretty much the, you know, and you just use it. Your film speed is what really controls the entire. You know, if it's 32, I like to shoot 3200 in bright sunlight.
So everything is in focus?
Yeah, and it just makes it makes things really odd, especially when you're in a city and you're shooting in the shadows and you've got 3200 and it's a bright sunny day, and it really hits the things it needs to hit. And then ultimately, I like to shoot 100 in bright sunny and in dark, and, you know, in sunset-y kind of.
Mostly things. Black and white?
All black and white.
All black
and white. Well, I've shot color, but if I cross-process it.
You use color negative film.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'll take it down to a place in New York, and I'll just tell them to cross-process it and see what I get from there.
Explain cross-processing.
Cross-processing, basically I'm telling the guy to just throw it in the next batch of color that he has, and whatever I get is what I get. If it's slide film, he'll process it in print chemistry, and it just, whatever.
Have fun with it.
Yeah, that's how I view photography is, really the composition and understanding film speed are really the two things that you need to get your head around, and then just go. Just go.
And your camera does not have a meter inside.
No. I have like an Argus that's kind of got some things. I don't think I have a camera that's over $50. They're all just, some are made of metal and they're Russian, and they're, you know, you'd think you're going to pay a lot of money for them, but they're, because they're knockoffs of nice German cameras. it's just, I like light leaks. I like whatever is going to happen. That's
happy accidents.
Happy accidents. And some things are completely ruined and some aren't. You just learn from your mistakes and you keep moving.
And Victor, how do you photograph?
Wow. any opportunity I'm given, I try to keep a camera with me. I do use the phone camera quite a bit for, documenting family, primarily. But I always try to have a film camera with me, and it really doesn't matter which camera is with me. I sometimes set out and say, okay, like I'm going to New York tomorrow to see some family from Europe that I've never met, actually. And I'm going to bring a Holga, and I'm going to bring a 35mm or pinhole. And I like pinhole because it just renders, broad shapes. You don't get to see someone's face. You get to see somebody's outline. You can't tell what building that is, but you know it's a building. The car is moving because, the exposure is long enough that it's not going to freeze a car in motion. And I like that. I like conveying time and almost timelessness at the same time in my images. With the Holga, I've been shooting with a Holga for about a decade. Somebody gave one to me, and it's really a fantastic device in that it renders a very soft focus, dreamy quality to images, and I work with that. I've shot weddings using a Holga. And then there's other work I do. I have a studio at home where I do portraits. My primary love, my primary way of shooting portraits is shooting tintypes or shooting large paper negatives using a view camera. I have a couple of view cameras from, one is from about 1880. I used that for shooting tintypes that shoots what used to be called the whole plate size, which is 8.5 by 6.5 inches.
Nice.
And then I've got like a 1920s Gundlach Corona view, which is an 8 by 10, and I'll shoot a paper negative in that and then contact print that. So, I like, again, long exposures, multiple seconds. I like to have the person in, very sharp focus, and then, right behind them just blurs into, nobody knows really where you are, what's going on, to really just put that focus on the individual. So, I think all cameras are interesting. I've built cameras out of giant cookie canisters. I've got a big biscotti tin that the format, with a hole. And I painted the inside matte black and everything. And, it shoots an 8x20 piece of photo paper. And a short exposure in broad daylight's about 10 minutes.
Wow.
And, I remember. You showed me that. That is awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
They're cool. I want to bring it to Times Square, but I'm scared.
Oh,
I'm going to get tackled by security. Walking around with a cookie tin.
Yeah, they do watch you.
And there was a point right after 9/11 where I was walking along the Jersey waterfront near the George Washington Bridge, getting down by the water to take I could show you the image of the George Washington Bridge shot with my cookie tin. And there was a helicopter following me as I'm walking along the water. And it didn't stop until I left. And so I'm there in the water, with the cookie tin.
With a shiny metal object.
Right. We're looking up constantly because I'm scared some sniper is going to get me. And it was great. I mean, the image is fantastic. I'll point you out to it. In fact, any of the images that I'm talking about, you can find on my website, which is at vmilin.com is my web address, my URL. And there's examples of my pinhole from the big cookie can, as well as tintypes and all other types of photography that I
can. You put that tin on a tripod?
Yeah, definitely. The camera, it has to be on a tripod. I think a short exposure is about a second, and that's broad daylight. In broad daylight, but if you're shooting under a tree, it's probably closer to 5 or 6 seconds. So it requires the person to be pretty still. One couple in the area, actually, I shot their wedding. I shot two tintypes at their wedding, and they're just so beautiful, and they're so timeless because also the people wore antique clothes. So it really between, the lens being from that period, the process being from, basically the Civil War, predating the Civil War, It really turned out to be a beautiful heirloom that, you know, they have to this day. So, yeah, it's nice. It's a physical object. That's actually one of the things I really like about analog photography is, you know, the eventual output is going to be, you know, something that you can hold, whether it's, you know, 140-pound, you know, watercolor paper with a platinum print, whether it's a nice heavy, you know, Czech paper, you know, that I use for regular silver printing, or whether it's, you know, a tintype where it's something you can hold and, you know, can actually lean it against the wall if you don't want to mat it and frame it. You know, I like that. I like the idea of creating physical objects and the ultimate, you know, distillation of all your work being something that you can hold as opposed to something somebody shows you on the back of the phone and goes, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I know.
I go, it's a nice phone.
I can't ever see it. I wear glasses, so people are holding their friends up to me. I don't know what you got. You know, it just looks like color.
Well, when both of you are out on the street photographing, do people ever come up to you and say, hey, what are you doing? What are you photographing?
When I first started doing street photography, I wore headphones. That just because of that, because people were talking to me. I'm also a fast shooter. There's only 12 images on a roll, 120 that goes in a Holga, so I'm one and out. And that's really when you get snagged. If you start shooting like 1, 2, 3, 4, taking a long time to set up your composition, you're going to have a lot of interest. People are going to ask you what you're doing. So when I first started shooting, I wore headphones and just could go about my business. And I could see people coming near me, but I didn't really pay attention to it. And then I stopped doing that when people started getting smacked in the face for their for their headphone things. So I just really don't pay any attention to, and I'm mindful of property lines. And tourists want to know what I'm shooting at, because then what I've noticed is funny behavior. I'll take a photo of something, and I will see tourists watching me do that. And then they'll come and take the same photo that I've just shot. It's the weirdest behavior is public behavior, you know. They don't know why that I'm shooting. It's not like I'm shooting the Empire State Building. I'm just shooting maybe some weird thing that I saw coming out of the subway that when they come over there, it's not there anymore, but I took a picture of the subway. So
they must be curious. What?
Yeah.
What does she see that I don't?
Well, the cameras that I carry, too, are weird. I have a Holga. It's a panoramic, and it's about the size of a brick dimensions. And so this is weird-looking plastic camera that nobody understands what it is. And it has a viewfinder that I don't always use because it's cumbersome. So I just kind of eyeball it up to my face as to where I want it. And it has a little bit of distortion on the edges. I really like it. It's a lot of fun to play with. But that gets a lot of... Police will look at me. Tourists will look at people. Everybody's like, what the hell is she doing? So that... I don't always like carrying it because I don't want to be seen so much. I want to be invisible. And the older I get, the more invisible I am, which is actually nice. It's really nice to be that way because you can just float in and out and nobody really notices you.
And Victor, do you have the same experience?
Oh, I sometimes shoot with a twin lens reflex. Like I have an old Rolleiflex that I use. And, you know, that's just a conversation starter right from the beginning. But one of the nice things about that camera is nobody can really see what you're taking a picture of because you're looking down into the camera as opposed to out at what you're photographing. It's got, you know, two lenses on it, and it's quite a cool-looking object. So people will always be like, whoa, that's a really old one. Yes, yes.
Yes,
how observant of you. You know your camera, sir. And, you know, when you put a tripod out and you put a view camera on it and you hide your head under a dark cloth.
Do you know you can't shoot with a tripod anymore?
I know.
Isn't that's just, I don't know what's coming.
You mean in Manhattan?
You can't. Yeah, you have to get a permit.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, I not so much anymore. I used to carry a tripod everywhere because I have a bulb exposure on just about anything I'm using, and I like that. Now I'm just using, you know, parts of stone and things, but you cannot carry a tripod. You have to get a permit.
And permits now are very expensive. They used to be
free.
They're
just a pain in the butt, yeah. Really.
They make it a pain on the butt.
Yeah, they do. They make it a pain in the butt because I think it's only good for one day or something.
Yes.
And then each day, you know.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's you're talking about New York. I mean, it's geared towards, you know, someone shooting that has somebody else in the company getting the permits for that person.
Yes.
So the individual, you know, a photographer who wants to go out and just do their own thing, it's not really bringing, I think, the kind of revenue that the mayor is looking for. So for that reason, You know, everything's kind of geared towards the big professional outfits.
Yes, of course.
I use street lights.
Absolutely.
I use people's heads.
Yes.
my wife's a little shorter than I, and I've used her head as a tripod at times. And, you know, whatever there is, if it's absolutely sharp, you know, I great, you know, that's nice. But that's not really what's important.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, the cameras that I'm using sharp is really, when I get something super sharp, I'm not even sure how that happened because, you know, it's usually the film I'm using. It's not anything I did. But after so much of walking around the city and putting my camera on things, at some point, I'll have like halfway through the day, I'll put the camera up to my face and realize it's been on 1,000 objects in New York and now it's by my mouth. It's disgusting.
Exactly. I never thought of that.
Yeah, it's you will now. It'll be there.
And Victor, you spoke about tintypes.
Yes.
And that's not a term a lot of people know of. And can you explain what a tintype is, when it got started? And
sure. Yeah. The first photographic process most people are familiar with is the daguerreotype, which is a image on a silver plated piece of copper. And so if you see these little cases and you open them up at antique shops or flea markets, if it looks like a mirror, that's a daguerreotype because it's on a polished piece of silver. The next process after the daguerreotype that became, you know, popular in the world of photography was the wet plate collodion process. In the wet plate collodion process, you take several chemicals, collodion, ether, grain alcohol. You mix those together. I know. It's
awesome.
Like a party. It's like a party.
That's how I grew up.
And some cadmiums and some bromides and some salts. And you mix it together and you make a substrate which will hold silver. You then pour it onto a glass plate or if you want a negative or on a piece of tin. You immerse that in a silver bath. It's a bath of water, distilled water and silver nitrate. And the collodion will be covered in the silver in about 3 minutes of sensitizing. You then put that in a plate holder and you bring that to the back of your view camera. You make your exposure. And while the collodion is still wet, you have to develop the plate, whether it's the glass or the tin. If you're using glass, you know, so you splash the developer on, you fix it. So in the past, people will have seen tintypes if you see images of Civil War Civil War fighters in those little cases, or anything where you see a small face in a case and it's kind of a brownish and black image. That would be a tintype. So it was very popular from about the 1850s to the 1880s. And it became, I believe, about the first time where most people were able to afford to get their picture taken. I had read that Civil War battlefield photographers would charge $1 for a small.
That's a lot.
Yeah, sixth plate. They were making $8 a month, the soldiers, and they would charge $1 for a sixth plate, which is like a 3x4 inch image. And all of the soldiers would send these home to their families and to their girlfriends. And so millions of images were actually made then. And since it's a highly stable process, it's on a piece of metal and it's covered in varnish, it's basically, most of them are still extant unless, you know, they were destroyed. And the photographers would make about $200 a day.
Wow.
You know, at these big battlefields. So it's a beautiful process. It's one that I feel confident, you know, I'll always be able to practice because I use raw chemicals. I'm not reliant on Kodak or Ilford. I order from chemical companies to mix all of the materials I use. And again, you can make it on a glass plate and that'll give you a negative. Or if you actually shoot it onto a piece of blackened tin, you shoot the image directly in the camera onto that plate, you will have, you know, an authentic tintype.
Now, wasn't the famous image of Billy the Kid done with a tintype?
Yes.
And because the tintype is left is right,
yes,
and right is left, it looked like he was left-handed.
Correct.
And it turned out he was, you know, if you do it properly, he's right-handed.
Yeah. Most cameras, what people don't realize about, you know, most cameras is the image is reversed and upside down, unless there's a mirror in the camera that flips it.
Yeah.
So when you look through a view camera, you know, there is no mirror. You're looking directly through the lens onto a piece of glass where the image is being projected, and the image is upside down. You look through it, and the person or whatever you're trying to shoot is upside down. So when you make the image, either a daguerreotype or a tintype, since you're not going to reverse it like you would with film, when you print it, the image will be in reverse. So yeah, if you shoot, as a lot of modern tintypists do, if they shoot someone wearing a t-shirt that says, you know, Boston sucks, for instance.
Yay.
It'll be in reverse.
I knew it would come out.
But that doesn't mean Boston doesn't suck.
Yes, of course.
But people will be reversed. Like, you'll look at someone you know and say, yes, that looks like Holly, but there's something different.
It's like the other side of Holly.
It's the dark side of Holly. So if Billy the Kid, you know, people think he's a lefty and he's
so
not a lefty,
it would probably be because of.
Yeah, but one of the cool things I think about those processes, the daguerreotype process and the tintype process, is since there is no second generation print generated from a negative, that a physical object actually has, you know, there's been a chemical change affected by the light that bathed, you know, the object or the person that was in the presence of that tintype or that daguerreotype plate. So you're literally holding something that, you know, still has some energy in it that was transformed by Lincoln or by Yosemite or by Sitting Bull. And it's a beautiful process, and one that, you know, I think there's a lot of really great practitioners of now. If anything, I think the numbers are growing pretty significantly since I started practicing this about, you know, 6-7 years ago. And even with the daguerreotype process, which is even, you know, far more difficult than the tintype process, which is still far more difficult than, say, you know, traditional black and white photography, there's some people doing some really fantastic work in that field. It's actually a film coming out called Artists and Alchemists that focuses on about 10, you know, modern practitioners of both the daguerreotype and the wet plate collodion tintype process. And, you know, it's something that, you know, we in that practice are very excited about. But I think it'll be a very interesting film for anyone who's interested in antique photographic processes.
Holly, how do you go from negative to print?
It depends. If I don't do my own printing, I send it out, and it just depends what I need. If I need, like, say I'm in a show and the show has. It's a big show. It has a lot of requirements that they need for me to hang there. I'll send it out and have just a basic C print. The thing about photography is it's expensive.
Yes.
That's the bottom line of it. So I'm a cheap girl. Yeah. I got to keep my overhead way low. So, and that is actually what drove me into use a lot of the cameras that I use, you know, Brownies and things like that. I'll send it out to get a basic C print, and then a lot of times what I'll do is I'll scan them, and I have an Epson that was 8-ink thing that
Inkjet.
I use. And I'll print them that way. But I don't print a show out of that. I'll send it out for a show.
But when you're saying a C print, that's a darkroom process.
Yes, that is just one that I'm not doing.
But it sounds like you also will have digital prints.
That I have for myself. Yeah. And then I'll scan to put online and things like that. But I don't, if I were selling it, it would be a C print. It wouldn't be a digital C print.
Even black and white, would you do a C print?
Yeah.
Now, isn't a C print normally for color?
No.
I print my own, but I don't know what a C print
is.
Yeah,
no, a C print is just down and dirty, like, you know, some kind of regular down and dirty paper. And
so I always thought the C print was for making color prints.
No, I think, I don't know.
It's been a long time.
I know. But
do you mean an RC print?
Well, we just always called it a C print.
Yeah.
You know, you're in the darkroom about this size, and you're just messing around with a lot of different papers that are all just Kodak papers, just cheap, and it was C print. And I never developed color because I can't do total black and white, you know, darkroom, total dark room. So, but that's. But I've always heard it as just a C print.
Yeah, I actually don't myself remember. I mean, for me, C print was color. Therefore, maybe the C and C print. But
maybe.
Then there was Cibachrome, which is usually, I think, chrome transparency going to a print.
Yeah.
And for me, black and white printing was just black and white.
Black and
printing.
White. Yeah. No, I know. Just. That's what we always call it, a C print, but it may not be technically known as that.
Mm. So I would imagine both of you have an understanding of color, even when a print is going through a computer and you're scanning, you have to know magenta and blue and yellow and cyan and how to get your proper rendition of the image that you're looking for. And Holly, it sounds like you're up for anything. If it's a little blue, that's all right.
Yeah, I just colors are, I like vibrant, very vivid. So I'll press that if I need to. That's why I like cross-processing, because blues become greens and yellows become something else entirely. So.
And Victor, when you're doing a tintype, is it the rendition of the tintype always going to be the same tone?
You know, it's an interesting process, because your chemistry can just suddenly stop working after working perfectly well for like 6 months. Your collodion ages and it becomes slower, but it gives you a greater variance of tonality. Like it's very, very contrasty when you mix a fresh batch, and as time goes on, it becomes slower. And then obviously comes a time where it just stops working. There's two types of fixers. One will give it a more, and you can add additional chemicals to give it more of a kind of a golden tone as opposed to like a cream tone. And then you can use just traditional, you know, sodium, fixer, you know, regular darkroom fixer, instead of using, there's another fixer I use, which is a little bit more toxic. I try to keep that out of the house. It's dangerous, you know, for everything that lives. And so, you know, having a 5-year-old running around and four cats, you know, I do my best to keep them away from the such things.
And are you also doing platinum?
I am, actually. Platinum, cyanotypes, calotypes, a lot of late 19th, early 20th century processes. I mean, my favorite photographers are, you know, besides contemporary practitioners of you know, what are antique processes or now called alternative processes, you know, I like Steichen and Alvin Langdon Coburn and Paul Strand and... I think that was, you know, the golden age of photography, the gum bichromate over platinum prints. But also, you know, people during like Gustave Legray or Nadar, you know, the very early, you know, French photographers were tremendous. They were actually creating the science. They were creating. Nobody really knows how Legray was able to capture, you know, the water standing still, since it was, you know, many times faster than what anybody else was able to do using the same process at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, they were giants, and they really, you know, brought a beauty and a workmanship that I think, to a large extent, maybe, at least from my perspective, has been lost in the intervening years.
What did Edward Curtis and Matthew Brady use as a process?
Yeah, Brady, you know, he's very early. He was doing a lot of tintypes. He also would shoot. So if you shoot onto a piece of metal, you get a tintype. If you shoot onto a piece of glass and you increase the density by increasing the exposure, you get a glass plate negative. So he would do both. But he was a collodion practitioner, as were, you know, people who worked in his studio and then went on to, you know, shoot the American West. People who worked for Brady when he was, you know, going to battlefields in the Civil War became people that the U.S. government sent out to shoot the West. And so you'll see these old images of like Utah, New Mexico. And those were people who actually, you know, had worked for Brady. And what's interesting is, you know, they would have giant, you know, mule packs. You know, they would have mule trains of 10 mules, and they would have glass, big glass plates. And they were shooting in these forests and shooting in these canyons. Now, Edward Curtis was also shooting glass plates. He does something interesting. When he makes a print, what he does is he uses banana oil and gold in the final product. So he actually has an image, his best work, I think his highest quality work, actually encompassed a process. I can't think of the name now, but he really spent a lot of time and energy on making prints. But to my understanding, he was using, you know, glass plates. I think at that point they were using the dry plate process.
He used banana oil.
He would use gold flakes suspended in banana oil. If you look at, you know, some of Curtis's work, you know, he would have different qualities. He would have some that he would just print as, you know, like a platinum, believe it or not, just a platinum print or a calotype, which is a silver print that looks similar to a platinum. But he had these I think he called them aura tones, and he would actually shoot, you know, it would actually be like a glass plate, and the highlights underneath would be like a piece of paper that he had sensitized, like gold and banana oil holding the gold. Hmm. And then he would put the glass plate on top of the gold, whatever it's being suspended on, and then case that together. So if you see some of those Curtis images and you see the gold in the highlights where normally it would be like white,
right,
or gray, that's I believe they're called aura tones.
And did Curtis and Brady take their darkroom on location? Did they have to?
Yeah, Brady was working a good deal earlier, and he was using what was the wet plate process. The wet plate process pretty much lost its place in the sun in the 1880s, where they came up with the dry plate process. The problem with the wet plate process is, you know, you have to shoot the image and develop it within about 5 minutes. So you have to make the plate, shoot it, come back to your tent or your dark box, and, you know, which is, you know, you could have red light sensitive, you know, so it doesn't have to be completely dark, but you have to develop it within 5 minutes. With the dry plate process, those were now being manufactured by Kodak, and you can bring boxes of them, expose them, and then wait till you got back from your journeys to either have Kodak develop them or develop them yourself. I think most people in that situation, you know, if you go across, you know, the United States photographing vanishing tribes of Native Americans, you're not going to send this out in an envelope. I'm pretty sure Curtis is using the dry plate, whereas Brady, being about, you know, 30 years earlier, was shooting the wet plate. What's really interesting is Brady had, you know, studios in all of the big cities. He had one in New York, maybe more than one in New York, one in D.C., one in Baltimore. And he had a lot of children, like, doing the actual work. So he had little kids could actually,
child,
you know, sensitize,
yeah, right,
sensitize the plate, mm-hmm, you know, get the person in the sunlight that was coming through the skylight and go, okay, about 6 seconds, you know, shoot the plate, you know, pass it through to somebody else who's developing in the next room and go, okay, got it, take care, next. And so he really, nice. he was a real operator, literally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he really became a very, very big, you know, depictor of the most important people of the time. Everybody went to Brady's studio.
Holly, do you want to get into any of these processes? Interesting.
They are very fascinating. No.
Good choice, I think. Let Victor do it.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It's a lot to do and work and think about, and I like the simplicity of what I've been doing, and I like trying new cameras and playing with new cameras and just pushing it that way, getting my head around how cameras work and taking cameras apart and trying to put them back together again. Mm. And breaking a lot of cameras that way. Especially cause some of them are just held together by a tiny little spring. So,
are all your cameras, can you, like a regular 35 millimeter camera, you can shoot, say, 36 exposures, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, then rewind,
yes,
take it out, put another roll in.
Yes.
But a lot of your cameras, you cannot do that because you load in the dark.
No. It's paperbacked. The 120 is paperbacked, so I can do that on the street at any point and just, you know, load and unload, try to do it in the shade. But no, there's the 35, that all the cameras that I have, it's just rolled. You put it in and it rolls into its another self, and then you roll it back. And
my father was a photographer, and he would do his color and black and white processing in our house. And when I would see the paperback, I don't know what you're talking about. It's a medium format where the film has a paperback to it, and it's separated, but it protects the film. And I always thought my father was throwing away film.
Oh, right.
Because
right,
in a garbage can, there'd just be tons and tons of long paper rolls.
There's one camera that I want to get. It's a Kodak. It's a Brownie, and I can't remember if it's the name. It's. I think it's a 127 Brownie. You have to load the camera in the dark, and you have to unload it in the dark because it wants you to pre-roll. You know, you're sticking your own thing in there, and the camera is like becomes the roll of film. So I want to play around with that, and I would just load it once and take it in to wherever I'm going, and then that would be what I shoot and then not change film on it. So I would have another backup camera.
Is film, does film still come on a roll? Can you get bulk film still?
Yes, actually, I've been looking into that because I want to buy this camera and make sure I can still do the things I want to do. Yeah, you can, and they even have the old bulk loaders. You can still buy what we all saw in college, those hand-cranked things.
Either of you interested in motion capture at all, or is it all still?
Well, I mean, if I'm doing a long exposure, like with my cookie tin, my cookie tin camera shooting on paper, it's a 10-minute exposure. And I think one of the things I like about that is things that aren't moving will be perfectly rendered. Things that do move, like trees, water, people, will be rendered as ghosts or just shadows. Or water will just look smooth like, you know, a piece of glass. Trees will look, you know, leafless, you know, especially in the fall or spring, because the leaves are moving in the wind, so they're not going to be in any one particular place long enough. One of the neat things is if you shoot, I shot last year on Worldwide Pinhole Day, which is one day where everybody in the world who shoots pinhole contributes an image to a website, you know, for the Worldwide Pinhole Day website. I shot the herd of cows at the Hawthorne Valley Farm, and some cows were perfectly happy eating and stayed exactly where they needed to stay for 9 minutes without moving. And other cows kind of walked away towards the food. So, you know, you have ghost cows kind of trailing, you know, and you can see the trees behind them, you know, through them actually. Whereas the cows that stayed in place for the whole 9 minutes are perfectly rendered. So, I mean, that's how I like to use, you know, motion in my images, is to actually have, you know, things that are moving, you know, appear to be moving, you know, that motion to be, you know, captured.
Has the demise of Kodak changed the business much?
The business, well, there's two businesses. I mean, there's a commercial photography business, and then there's just the stuff that the Victor and I do. I think it makes it harder for us to find things. I used to shoot a lot of Polaroids. I have thousands and thousands of Polaroids. And when, you know, they closed that down, the biggest problem now is the Impossible Project has brought back the ability to shoot Polaroids. The trouble is it's so expensive. It's just, it's really, really expensive just to get 8 shots. It's like almost $30 now,
right.
I think.
Wow.
And that immediately affects the way that I shoot. If I get a little packet of eight photos, I'm not going to shoot the way I used to shoot with a Polaroid. So that's what, if anything, that's changed. The way that Victor and I probably shoot is just the ability to get it, how much we have to pay to get it from, if we're just getting something shipped from Russia, you know, how much a shipping costs, and by the time we actually get it, it takes out that seeing what you want to see in the blink of an eye kind of thing, because then your second guessing is, oh, do I really want to shoot this because I got only 7 other tries or something like, or it takes me a month to get this chemistry or this paper or this film. This one I was just telling Victor, this one film that I used to use that I loved because it was just so wrong and screwy, it came from the Czech Republic, and they don't make it anymore. They've stopped. Or I'm not sure if they've stopped or they've just stopped letting it into the country. I'm not really sure which. But I can't use it anymore. So.
Well, Polaroid is gone. But
Polaroid is gone,
they make TVs now.
But
bad TVs.
It used to be, I mean, it was synonymous with that process, or what you might call instant film.
Mm-hmm.
So now that Polaroid's gone, what is it called?
What is the Impossible Project called?
They just have a product. So this
they can't
company
use the
based
word.
In where are they? They're in like Germany?
Yeah, I think. Or
the Netherlands.
Something like that.
Sorry for my Dutch and German friends for mixing those two countries up. But their materials, the materials Polaroid still had in their production facilities as well as the equipment was sold to a group that wanted to continue making Polaroid,
but they
materials.
Had they weren't given the instructions.
No,
they had to
no.
figure
they
out their own
figure
chemistry.
It out, and I think they hired some of the engineers.
Some of them, but the first batches were just
they were
really
terrible.
Nasty.
But like Holly says, you know, I have an 8x10 Polaroid back, which I think the last time you could buy 8x10 color Polaroid film, it was, you know, like $11 in exposure, and it's been brought back by Impossible Project, and it's like double that. And any time, you know, I'm faced with the idea of shooting an image that costs $22,
oh, yeah.
it's less than boy, I could really, you know, make like five tin types. Like, well, I could make platinum prints for less than than the price of a Polaroid.
So my Polaroid sits there, you know, and I have two of them actually. Yeah. And I have a couple backs. I have two Polaroid backs for my Holgas.
Right.
And I have a refrigerator half full of old Polaroid film.
Cool.
That I'm afraid of you. I mean, I'm not afraid of it. I just, it really affects, like, whenever we go anywhere and how many cameras, you know, how many 20 cameras do I want to bring? That always stays at home. Yeah. Or I'll bring it, I'll never use it. So that has changed. That has definitely changed. Commercially, I think that, you know, the age of digital has just wiped out so much of that. I know some photographers who shoot professional prefer to still shoot film.
Mm-hmm.
Or what I know some people are doing is they'll shoot digital video. They'll shoot video and then they'll pull their stills off of that, which is interesting.
It's a different world, isn't it, for photography? I mean, it's changing. It hasn't stopped changing yet.
Well, I don't think it's really a different world. I think it's just the same. Keep moving. You know, look at what Victor was talking about, how they did 100 years ago with the tintypes and stuff for the Civil War. That was commercial photography. That was mass producing these images for people to send to people or to have or to hold. It's always been about that. Kodak invented the Brownie for the same reason. It was a cheap camera that everybody could get, and we could all be photographers. All the way up now to we all have a camera on our phones, so everybody has the ability to be a photographer. It's the same thing. It just the technology changes, but the desire is constantly there.
I kind of like that the Brownie is today's smartphone.
Yes. No, you're right. You're right. And that product right there, the Brownie, has been going on for probably 90 years. I think they just kept regenerating each one. It started out as weird little foldy cameras, but everybody has a Brownie in their attic somewhere that dad used or grandma used or something.
I could replace my camera phone with just, you know, a Brownie, a carrier pigeon, and like a pocket full of quarters. I think I'd be the better for it, right? The phones are amazing. The fact that you can take a like 11 meg image on a phone.
Oh my God, I know.
And print it, you know, like 20x30. I have a good friend who was it photogravure? And he literally takes, you know, he's got a bunch of great old Leicas that he uses, but at the same time, he shoots on his iPhone, you know, makes a negative that then he can use to make, you know, a photogravure. And then he actually will be in his garage with his press, inking his press to make these images. So you know, there's a lot of people, they take their old prints and they scan them, they put them online. He's taking a digital image and he's making it analog, and then he's making, you know, on this beautiful Somerset paper these works of art from something he shot, you know, sitting at the lake with his phone. So
right.
I think that's, you know, kind of the beauty is that, you know, some of the digital pieces can certainly make the analog more effective, and you know, for instance, you know, I'm not walking around with a 13x19 camera. it's a little unwieldy and I'll need a mule to carry the plates around. But if I can shoot something and then scan a print and then make a 13x19 negative to make a platinum print or to make a cyanotype, you know, and get that negative from my Epson 2200,
right.
That's great. I mean, that's beautiful. It allows me to do better work in the analog world by having that digital assistant. So you did bring up something earlier, though, about Kodak, which, you know, I don't think I had a chance to or I didn't address. You know, it scares the hell out of me, to be honest with you. You know, the idea that, you know, one day film will go away. Like,
I don't think it will. I absolutely don't think it
but,
will.
But I've gone through, I mean, I've only been at this for about a decade now. My first favorite paper was Kodak Polymax. And then it became, you know, Forte, and then it became Agfa, and then it became, you know, Varicon, and then it was Slavich, and all of these companies are just, you know, one after another, just going by the wayside. Every time I feel like I've mastered a paper, you know, and I found the right chemistry and the way to use it. It's just, it's, you know, the company's gone. I mean, I had a friend say, you know, that one actually, you know, when Forte went, she said, you know, it actually made me cry. I'm like, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
know?
Absolutely.
And we're all running to Adorama when we hear Agfa is going out because we're all buying like cases of Agfa.
That's what I did with
my
Polaroid
portfolio's
film.
On Agfa.
I did the same thing when they were saying we're going to discontinue instant film. I just, I, you know, was out there just spending hundreds of dollars trying to suck up all the film I could. Yeah. But, and now I won't touch it.
Okay. What's interesting is Fuji is a big player in, you know, they're based out of Japan. They're still releasing expensive film cameras.
Oh, yeah. No, they're
Really dedicated to film. The Japanese market has a very deep love of film.
Yep.
And so they're still making film products. So even if, you know, Kodak does cease, even though it's the only part of Kodak that's profitable is the film and chemistry business. Even though that's the only part where Kodak makes money. If they do spin that off, it is certainly enough profit for a company to, you know, that doesn't have eight levels of senior management to take that and run that like a business and continue to make money. And if they increase the price 20% a year because silver goes up, I mean, photographers will just, you know, find a way to make it work.
And it's expensive. That it is an art form that a lot of people can't have access to. I know that, you know, when I got out of school, I was a designer. I had to be a designer. And I've shot commercially before, but there's just no money as a straight photographer. Victor and I don't make any money on photography. We just can't.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a shame.
It is a shame. You know, it becomes that whole support the arts conversation that I'm not sure we want to get into. But it's, you know, that if they discontinue something, we're going to pay more to find it or find something better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in a way we've sort of segued into, and we've started with the cameras, the film, the processing. Now, if we could sort of close out the hour talking about the print and the exhibition of the print and the sad news that Holly just delivered that we can't can't make a living. Well, most people, the vast majority, the mere 99.9% cannot make a living. The exhibition of your images, both of you, how's that going?
Well, I have a gentleman in Amsterdam who likes my work. So I'm in a gallery over there, which this is the first, this has ever happened in my life that somebody's really requested a lot of work for me. And so I'm not really sure. I'm not thinking about it. I've sent him all the pieces that he wants and then I'm just not thinking about it.
And you're showing in Paducah.
Yes, I'm in the Paducah show in Kentucky, that was a big thing too. And it's little blips and blobs here and there. It's fun to show, but my perspective is I get the piece together, I get it all where it needs to be and Martha sends it off and I don't think about it.
Yeah.
I don't think about it until I'm told that I have to get it back home. So, but it's, again, if you just don't think about it, you don't get discouraged.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Victor, for you, how's it going?
You know, it's not, you know, for a lack of trying, it hasn't gone well for the last few years, mostly because I basically stepped back, both when I became a father and also when I moved my father here. He had been very sick. And so, you know, photography has been something that, you know, for me, it's like a full contact sport. You're either in it or you're not in it. To try to, you know, fit creativity into like a 15-minute window of opportunity just is more frustrating and will just, you know, make me angry about it. So really, I think for maybe the first time in about 4 years, I'm starting to spend more time getting work together again and taking commissions for portraits and sending some work out. I had and continue to have representation out in LA. It seems there a lot of my imagery is based around New York City. It's where I grew up and I still spend a lot of time there. I have family there and you know, there's no shortage of New Yorkers in LA, so you know, gallery there likes my images and continues, you know, to put my work as part of group shows there. I also for a while was exhibiting through the Columbia, you know, Council on the Arts, which I think is a great organization.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hope to be getting back involved with that again soon. But really, you know, most of my work when I move work is primarily through, I'm a member of the Analog Photographers Users Group, which is called APUG. You know, it's at APUG.org. And besides there being a dedicated group of you know, photographers using film and paper, there's also collectors, and there's a place where people can. I have a portfolio there, and I do get a good amount of people via that vehicle. And also, I'm you know, post my work on Facebook, and you know, I have people reaching out to me. So I do a lot of direct sales. That's been something that, again, you know, I'm sometimes, you know, if I print a 30-inch piece, you know, and then I have to take a camera phone image of it to put it up on Facebook, it kind of loses something in the transition to somebody else's phone. And so I don't think it really displays well. So no, I definitely want to get back out there more. And but no, I really enjoy making the work. I make the work for myself, and the work makes me happy.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that when they come up in the developing tray and I see, you know, exactly what I was hoping for when I took this up, you know, when I said, wow, why do I want to, you know, use a camera, you know, to bring images like this, you know, into the world, when that rare occasion happens where that image is coming up in the developing tray and you're like, wow. So the pre-visualization, the exposure, the developing, you know, it all worked on this. You know, I guess it's how a golfer feels when they hit that perfect swing, you know, once every five times they go out, that they chase that all of the time. You know, I chase that all of the time. I chase, you know, making that perfect piece, you know, that I envisioned in my mind come into the world. So, yeah, I print for family. I print for friends, you know, and I'm happy to do so.
And Holly, you're capturing just about every day, aren't you?
Yes, I'm constantly taking photos. It happens. I can't imagine not taking a photograph. I think it would crush my soul, actually.
And how important is the internet for you?
Well, it's always been a big deal because of what I do for a living. I'm a designer. It's a great way to connect with people that you don't have to know. I have a website. It's hnorthrup.com, and there's 10 years of photography on that. I also have a Facebook page that I try to mirror what I'm posting on my website. I think it's just a really important way to communicate with people that you don't really have to communicate with.
Well, we've had a wonderful hour that went by awfully quick. And I want to thank Holly Northrup and Victor Millen for being here. And Holly just gave her website. And Victor, you just gave your website not too long ago. Any other ways that our listeners can find both of your works? Or is it just the website, find you on Facebook, track you down?
Yes.
Look in galleries.
Yes, yes.
And hopefully many of our listeners love photography, love collecting, and support a live artist.
A living artist.
A living artist. I think that's very important for all of us. So that's this Art of the Hudson Valley program. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we'll see you in another month on another edition on another subject, whatever that might be. And I just want to remind our listeners, this is WGXC 90.7 FM. And don't forget, create.